woman Agnes Wanjiru was found in 2012 after she went out partying with British troops at a hotel in the central Kenyan town of Nanyuku, where the British Army has a permanent garrison. Last October, one of the troops involved confessed to killing Wanjiru, and now the family of the murdered woman is demanding for justice. The governor of Kenya's Laikipia County, where the murder took place, says the crime brings back memories of atrocities committed by Britain during the colonial rule.
The revelations have reignited calls for an independent investigation and justice for Wanjiru. Kenyan authorities have announced that they are reopening the case. The sister of the murdered Kenyan is emotional over the revival of the murder file.
Recently, when the media started airing the story, it opened old wounds. It's like Agnes has just died. It has even affected her daughter, but we had to let her know what is going on. I pray that God grants the British government the wisdom to handle this case well. When I think of Agnes, I remember how happy she was. She loved to sing. She taught my youngest daughter how to sing. The person who killed Agnes should face the law, because the child who was orphaned has suffered a lot. Bearing in mind she was just 5 months old, even feeding at that time was difficult.
Well, for more on this murder file involving British troops in Kenya, my colleague contacted Patrick Gathara, a writer and political cartoonist. He's also the curator of the Kenya news website, The Elephant. Now, Mr. Gathara first explains here on why it has taken almost 10 years for this case to come back to limelight.
The case of Agnes Wanjiru has taken so long simply because she was killed initially by the British soldiers, she was missing for about 2 months before her body was actually recovered from a septic tank. And by the time she was found, her body was found, the soldiers had already left the country. And then that was the initial delay. Then there was also sort of quite a bit of delay in setting up an inquiry that then decided that the British soldiers were most likely responsible for her death. And in addition to that, there was quite a lot of laxity in terms of both governments in following up the case.
Well, the Defense and Foreign Relations Committee in Kenya's parliament has raised concerns that the authorities could be engaged in cover-up, hence delay in Agnes Wanjiru's murder case.
It's a scandal of a cover-up. It's purely because the junior officers reported to their seniors, and their seniors never took necessary action.
We asked Mr. Gathara to give us his take on why Britain's Ministry of Defense deliberately refused to investigate the brutal murder of Wanjiru in 2012 amid reports of a plot to cover up this heinous crime.
There was a deliberate attempt to cover it up, or at least to there was some hope that it would go away. I think we have seen in Kenya quite a number of cases involving British and even American soldiers and sailors, where they have come and committed crimes here, killed people, killed animals, started fires, you know, and stuff, and then kind of disappeared. So when they go away, and we don't really see justice done, we don't see them being pursued either by our own authorities here in Kenya or by the British or American authorities. So this is not a new thing, it's not the first time, and we need to keep in mind that there has been, since colonial days, a pattern where atrocities committed against locals are treated as if they are not very serious, and there is a tendency to sweep them under the rug.
Allegations against British troops serving in Kenya and elsewhere around the world have dogged the British government and military.
The UK has nothing to hide here. We want these investigations to be dealt with as quickly as possible. We want those responsible to be brought to justice.
Considering the foregoing, many are now wondering if there are any prospects for justice in this case, particularly considering the fact that British troops walked away scot-free after committing horrendous crimes in Kenya and elsewhere in the world. So, are the prospects quite slim?
I think the prospects are still quite slim. And again, it depends on what you define as justice. Right now, there is lots of talk of getting the soldiers extradited to Kenya to stand trial here. But the fact that you're seeing the names of the soldiers are still being kept secret, we still don't know who they are, the people who are to be extradited, means that it's quite questionable whether there is a lot of will to pursue this in a serious way. The other thing to think about is that given the time lag that we've had, more than 10 years, is the evidence still there to hold them guilty and to hold them accountable for this? So I think there's quite a lot of questions as to whether we can really secure a guilty verdict. And even if we were to get a guilty verdict, what would be the punishment? What would be a requisite punishment? Would they be, for example, jailed in Kenya, in Kenyan prisons? Or would we have a situation where they are sentenced here and then sent to prison in the UK?
Now, Kenyan members of parliament have threatened to reject a renewed military agreement signed recently between the country and Britain unless suspects in the killing of Agnes Wanjiru are extradited and prosecuted according to Kenyan laws.
So until we have concrete evidence to suggest that the Kenya government is looking into this matter and the culprit actually being brought back to Kenya to face our criminal justice system, then that's the time now we can probably append our signatures.
Now, Mr. Gathara speaks here about this military deal now that members of parliament in Kenya have threatened to shoot it down.
Well, I think it's a good question. I mean, why should we be giving British soldiers space to come in and do their military exercises here? Why don't they do them back at home? You know, and also, as you mentioned, given the fact that we have these sorts of conflicts between locals and the troops. We know, like, for example, there was a big issue about unexploded munitions being left lying around and people stepping on them or handling them and ending up getting injured. You know, and there was a court case and some compensation that was ordered paid. But it is still an issue. You know, why should we be allowing it? This is 60 years after independence. What are these deals about? And it's really important to remember that these are not agreements that the ordinary citizens are involved in. You know, they are really government-to-government ones. They take really very little account of whether or not the local population wants this this military people here, you know. So I think for me it's quite problematic. I think I see no reason and no justification for continuing to host foreign military people on our soil, especially when our people are having to pay such a high price for it.
Kenya's Defense Cabinet Secretary has acknowledged that justice has been delayed for the woman murdered by British troops, but has promised to ensure justice is served.
Indeed, justice has been delayed for Agnes Wanjiru and her young child, but it must not be denied. We must do everything to ensure, invoking the powers provided under the Defense Cooperation Agreement, to ensure that that is done.
The crimes committed by British troops in Kenya have gone unpunished, contrary to the agreement between the two countries. Some people believe this level of impunity by the British military is historical.
Historically, there has been a sense of impunity. I mean, if you go back 60 years to the Mau Mau conflict in the 1950s, we have till today people who are still alive, who committed terrible atrocities against the local population. You know, people who tortured people in the concentration camps that were set up, who ran these concentration camps, people who murdered people, you know, who were there. They are old now, but there has been absolutely no attempt to hold them to account for this. And we know that the British actually took out in 1963, just prior to independence, they stole a huge cache of documents, not just from Kenya, but from their colonies around the world, you know, in an attempt to actually hide the fact that these atrocities happened.
This is why Nuruddin Haji, Kenya's director of public prosecutions, says the government would request extradition of troops involved in the murder to face charges in Kenya.
It's going on well. I think as you saw on Friday, the DCI met with the British officials, and we have agreed on the best way to move. The court had, in the inquest, indicated that we proceed with the case, and after compilation by the DCI, we will be ready to proceed accordingly.
We asked Mr. Dadara to give us his final thoughts on what it will take to solve the Agnes Wanjiru murder file.
Well, there's a number of things I think are required to be done. The first is there has to be a serious, thorough, unfettered investigation of what happened in the case of Agnes Wanjiru, and a full-bodied prosecution here in Kenya, you know, of the soldiers. I think we need to get away from the impression that's created right now of this sort of anonymous soldiers. They need to be named. We need to know who they are. And we need to see that no, using the phrase that they like using, that no stone is left unturned in pushing for accountability for it. But beyond that, I think there needs to be serious discussions about why it is we are having soldiers from the British still active here in Kenya, why are they doing trainings here, and what are the safeguards, any, for local people so that we don't see this happen again.
Well, thanks, Mr. Gadara, Kenyan writer and cartoonist. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. Here at Africa Today, we shall continue following up the case of Agnes Wanjiru as the family seeks prosecution of British troops involved in this gruesome murder. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on how most of Africa's stolen art is still stashed in Western countries, despite exaggerated reports of the return of some of the looted artifacts. Stay with us.
Stolen African art stashed in Western museums.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The French government has returned some 26 artworks it looted from Benin. Now, this is just a fraction of thousands of items stolen by France in the 19th century from Benin, including from its palaces of Abomey, now a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Some of these artifacts were stolen by colonial administrators, troops or doctors, and passed down to descendants. Many of these looted artifacts are still in private collections, but hundreds of thousands are kept in museums across Europe and North America.
Speaking in Paris during the signing of an agreement to bring back the stolen art, Benin's president said the return of the 26 pieces is just a first step.
We hope that the restitution of these 26 works of art is just a first step in the ambitious process of restituting heritage pieces.
Now, for more on the struggle for return of all looted African artifacts stashed in European and North American museums, my colleague contacted Joseph Ochieno, a writer and African affairs analyst. Now, we first asked Mr. Ochieno his take on why Western countries are suddenly returning some of the cultural heritage items they looted in Africa.
This is a very important question, and I think it's the case that credit to media agencies like yourselves, credit to the campaigns by various African communities, organizations, and indeed a few progressive Western academic institutions, that following slavery and beyond slavery, it's time that now Africa should be able to have what belongs to it. The cultural artifacts were, like, if you like, amongst those things that very much determined the realities and the backbone of our civilizations. And they were looted and stolen. And of course, these are prized items that directly relate and link with the African communities. But beyond that, I think it is also the case that as the world moves on, a much more younger generation of Western citizenry and indeed scholars becoming part of the campaign for fairness and global justice. And that must therefore really include questions of artifacts or whatever other material items will have been looted from either Africa or any of the rest of the other worlds that were by and large colonized by Western powers.
According to some estimates, the Quai Branly Museum in Paris alone holds some 70,000 African objects, yet Macron handed over only 26 artifacts to Benin amid a media circus. A curator from a museum in Benin speaks before the return of the looted artifacts in this Paris museum.
These art pieces are of essential importance for Benin. It has been more than a century that these pieces have been removed from their historical context. These artifacts returning to the country today is just historical for the people of Benin.
Now, considering the high number of looted African artifacts being held in Western museums, is this highly publicized return of just a few of the looted items meant to hoodwink the public?
It was purely that, hoodwink, and I think it's scandalous, isn't it? Because up to 90% or thereabouts of precious African artifacts are held in either Western museum or libraries. So I think this is one of the things that needs to be done. And that is that African governments, African advocacy groups, and indeed global organizations, including news media like Press TV, as we talk today, should double their efforts in making sure that these loots are actually returned not only to Africa, but respective African communities. This is direct theft that took place hundreds of years ago, but it's the direct theft that now that has been established that who stole and where these items should be returned to the owners.
The president of Benin, Patrice Talon, made it clear that the handover was the first step in a large-scale restitution process. We asked Mr. Ochieno if there is any legal or political mechanism to compel European colonial powers to return all the artifacts they stole from Africa.
I think there would be a very important legal case. This must be a really important legal basis on which, as I said, the principal property and ownership, that if these are items that were taken from Africans by force and against the wills of many Africans, in many cases, brutalizing and killing the owners of these items, there's no reason why a legal test case is not put in place, number one. But number two, the Africans continue to advocate for reparations, including for and around slavery. I would be one of those people who would join part of that campaign and make sure that this is actually enhanced. That is both legally and indeed politically. But beyond that, I think African governments today should have the ability and the capacity to demand that these items are actually returned, and so are African academic institutions. So those are political pressures. But beyond that, I think African civil society organizations, and indeed possibly young African academicians, can actually opt to boycott some of the institutions that hold these items. That is to put pressure. Finally, I think global agencies that like the United Nations should surely be the space where these conversations should be able to take place and to compel the Western governments to return what really is not theirs and what is really, really African.
26 works of art stolen by France returned to Benin on the 10th of November. This was a landmark in the long fight by African countries to recover looted artifacts. A member of one of Benin's royal families believes the return is important for young people in the country.
the musée a construit.
I think the youth should take a keen interest in the museum that will be built. Because I think the youth is a bit lost in terms of tradition.
Are the masses in Africa, especially the youth, aware of the continent's artifacts looted by Western countries during the colonial period?
Part of the challenge is that many Africans possibly don't even know the fact that this kind of act does exist. Many of the African governments continue today, in many cases, to work and relate with many of these Western organizations, and so therefore calm down their citizens. But beyond that, going forward, as I say, you know, these are opportunities for tourism. These are opportunities for reclaiming our civilization. And thanks to programs like yourself, these matters and subjects must be on the national table. But guess what? While I know this through my research, campaigns and advocacy, I'm not quite sure how many nation states' televisions had these subjects that hit the headlines. Think about South Africa, would be the possibly the most established in terms of academia and universities and institutions of learning and research. In South Africa, I doubt. In Egypt, I doubt. In big Nigeria, I doubt. In Kenya, I doubt. So that tells you very, very few mainstream media organizations on the continent, whether state or perhaps private, would necessarily have covered this. So your guess is as well as mine. How are these things and these matters going to reach the conversational tables of average African citizenry?
Despite the return of the looted artifacts being a drop in the ocean, the people of Benin are jubilant and hopeful that this will be the start of full restitution.
Today we're so happy about what's happening in our country. We're so happy. What we've been looking for, it's for our artwork to come back to us.
Finally, we asked Mr. Ocheno, what is the significance of the restitution of stolen artifacts to the African people?
Ability that we can begin to have the conversations to heal the past and begin to move forward. And there is no other better way of healing the past than merely returning what is purely African. Because one of the things, and a good case would be made, both politically and legally, that not only is it the return of these items good enough, but imagine you borrowing, getting a loan, even if it's only 1% per annum, and is for over 130 or 150 years, how much would it be? So no, I think it's in the best interest of Western governments and these institutions to return our stuff under whatever circumstances. But going forward, I hope Africans will join part of this conversation and debate and demand for the return of these items, all of it really, but also make sure that in the event that there is a difficulty in returning, we make it as much a political case and a political question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ocheno. There you have it. He says African people must insist on the return of all artifacts looted by Western countries during the era of colonialism. On that note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It was great having you. Goodbye for now, and God bless you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5. and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia dismisses new U.S. media reports about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine, accusing Washington of trying to aggravate the situation while blaming Moscow. Pope Francis criticizes Europe's lack of coordination on migration, saying the continent is torn by nationalist egoism. And the number of daily COVID deaths in Iran reaches its lowest in 9 months. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Appreciate you joining us. Well, Moscow dismisses new U.S. media reports about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine. It instead accuses Washington of provocative actions near Russian borders. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman has been cited by a newspaper as saying that the U.S. is conducting a special operation to aggravate the situation around Ukraine. Maria Zakharova has accused Washington of adopting accusatory rhetoric to shift the responsibility for the escalation onto Russia. The remarks were made after a Saturday report by the Washington Post accusing Russia of planning a multi-front offensive on Ukraine early next year. Now, this is the second time in the past month that U.S. media has made such a claim. Moscow says the allegations could be aimed at diverting attention from Kiev's own plans to escalate tensions in eastern Ukraine. Political commentator Tim Kirby believes U.S. media reports about Russia's possible attack on Ukraine are part of Washington's broader campaign to create further rift between Moscow and Kiev.
We can't forget that since the Maidan Revolution of 2014, the mainstream media has reported that Russia has already invaded the Ukraine multiple times. Now they're writing that there is a threat of invasion. All right, so first off, this is already sort of in a 1984 nutty world. About the Russian reaction, Russians are very concerned right now that this is going to be what you could call the big one. When the mainstream media turns their eye to something, they always escalate or inflate, and it's never purely coincidental, I'll put it that way. There's a lot of events going on all over the world. Some are shown, some are not, and this one is definitely getting the hype as of today. I think that there is some sort of attempt to create a final rift between the Ukraine and Russia to sort of end this issue in a way that's going to be favorable to Washington. Because as Zbigniew Brzezinski said, Russia will never be, this is a paraphrase, Russia will never be a great empire or superpower again without the Ukraine. So perhaps that's what they're trying to do.
Well, the head of the Roman Catholic Church blames the EU's nationalist divisions for deepening migrant problems in Europe. Pope Francis says the European community avoids making decisions and at times is uncoordinated on the migrant issue. Francis called for unity among European countries in dealing with migrants. He made the criticism in a meeting with the EU and Greek officials while visiting Athens. Earlier in his trip, the pontiff condemned conditions in migrant camps in Cyprus. Greece is one of the main entry points into the EU for asylum seekers. Critics are warning of worsening condition for migrants and refugees across European borders. Well, the French president is in Saudi Arabia as part of a visit to a number of Persian Gulf Arab countries. Macron is the first Western leader to visit Riyadh since Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside of the kingdom's Istanbul consulate in 2018. More in the following report.
French President Emmanuel Macron met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the Saudi city of Jeddah and discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis in Lebanon, which has been suffering from economic hardships for the past several years. Macron's visit to Saudi Arabia is overshadowed by the 2018 assassination of Saudi critic and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. American intelligence agencies have concluded that the murder was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. The visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accuse the French president of trying to, quote, rehabilitate MBS. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations.
Whatever strategic interest France has in Saudi Arabia, Nothing can justify their legitimization of a ruler who kills journalists, threatens activists, imprisons women human rights defenders, slaughters Yemeni civilians, and deceives the international community. Macron diminishes himself and his country as he stoops to partnership with MBS.
Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that the dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. The visit is part of the two-day tour to the Persian Gulf that earlier took Macron to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a record $15.8 billion contract for selling 80 French Rafale warplanes. Rights bodies again came out vocal about the sale. They criticized the agreement, blaming the Emiratis for playing a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Signing a major weapons deal with a country involved in the war on Yemen raises speculations as to what exactly Paris is looking for in such trips. Such a sale is especially under the spotlight at a time when France has been deprived of a share in a lucrative security pact among Australia, the UK, and the US. That, along with the fact that France is one of the largest weapons exported to Saudi Arabia, brings one to the conclusion that France is only after selling its military hardware, despite the war crimes Riyadh has committed and the irreparable loss of hundreds of thousands of civilian lives during the ongoing war on Yemen.
The dispute over general elections in Iraq is dragging on. The head of Iraq's Fatah alliance, Hadi Amiri, has once again rejected the results. Amiri accuses the country's election commission of mismanagement and violations. He says the commission did not present any report on vote irregularities to parliament. Amiri promised not to back down from the lawsuit on election fraud and to continue the process in federal court. He also accused the UN envoy of Iraq to Iraq of interfering in the election process. On Tuesday, the Electoral Commission reconfirmed the political bloc led by Mokhtar al-Saad as the winner of October's parliamentary elections. Following weeks of recounting, the federal court now needs to approve the final results. The Fatah Alliance and several political groups oppose the vote outcome. Israeli forces shoot dead a Palestinian in occupied Al-Quds after an alleged stabbing attack. The incident took place near the Damascus Gate, just outside of the Old City. The Palestinian was identified as a 25-year-old man from the occupied West Bank. Israeli police said he tried to stab an officer after wounding a first man. Footage from the scene showed Israeli forces shooting at the man at least twice after he was already lying on the ground. Another video appears to show police with guns drawn, preventing medics from reaching the man. Clashes later broke out on the scene between Palestinians and Israeli forces who used stun grenades. Israel has repeatedly been criticized for extensive use of lethal force against Palestinians and their extrajudicial killings. Moving on to other news now this hour. Iran's chief negotiator to the Vienna talks says the two proposed drafts Tehran has presented to other parties cannot be rejected. Ali Bakri Khani told Al Jazeera TV that the draft documents are based on the provisions of the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. He added that Iran will submit a third proposal once the first two are accepted. He insisted that U.S. sanctions against Iran must be lifted immediately. Iran proposed its documents during the latest round of talks that ended on Friday in Vienna. Tehran has already made it clear that the negotiations should be result-oriented. It says the talks should lead to the removal of the sanctions that the U.S. imposed after it withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. Ebrahim Raisi became the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran in early August. During his time in office, Raisi has sought to strengthen ties with neighbors and other countries, particularly those on the eastern side of the globe. Domestically, he has focused on strengthening the country's vaccination campaign against the coronavirus pandemic. More in the following report.
August the 5th, 2021. Ebrahim Raisi becomes Iran's eighth president after a landslide victory in elections. He had little time to celebrate his win. Iran was facing a plethora of challenges from both within and without. Raisi had to steer the country under severe U.S. sanctions and hit by a raging global pandemic. The first order of business was making sure of people's health. When Raisi took the helm, Iran was recording over 30,000 daily COVID cases. Several hundred people were also losing their lives to the virus each day. In less than 5 months, the numbers began to fall significantly. Iran got to have just over 2,000 new coronavirus cases every day. The number of fatalities reported daily has fallen below 60, and 3 out of 5 Iranians have been fully vaccinated. Also, Hayyan Raisi's foreign policy agenda has been expanding ties with neighboring countries. To that end, in late August, Iran attended a summit in the Iraqi capital. There, Iran's foreign minister met with its counterpart from Persian Gulf states in a bid to strengthen bilateral ties. Raisi's foreign policy brought Iran a major milestone in September, when the country became a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a multinational body which includes the likes of China, Russia, and India, and enjoys wide-scale global influence. President Raisi has also tried to shore up the country's economy by relieving the pressure of sanctions. His government has taken part in the Vienna negotiations in a bid to have U.S.-imposed sanctions on Iran removed. The next round of talks is set to kick off next week. The challenges Iran is facing are by no means over. But judging President Raisi's first 4 months in office, better days seem to be in the offing for the country.
Well, the number of COVID deaths and infections are on a downward trend in Iran. The country has reported 58 deaths, the lowest in 9 months. Some 2,100 new cases have been reported during the past day. 19 out of 31 provinces had zero or one case in the same period. Health officials have not registered any cases of the new COVID variant in Iran. The decline in the number of deaths and infections is largely due to the country's mass vaccination drive. Nearly 48 million Iranians have received 2 doses of the COVID vaccine, and some 1 million others the booster shots. Well, nearly 2 weeks after the new COVID variant Omicron has been identified, alarms are raised over the economic impacts of the strand that may spread very rapidly. The International Monetary Fund is now saying that its October global economic growth projections will likely be downgraded. In that month, the IMF said that the global economy is expected to grow by 5.9% this year and 4.9% next year. That comes as the global economy has already been hit hard by the pandemic. The IMF particularly points out to soaring inflation and rising debt. It says more thoughtful and aggressive policy is needed to tackle the existing economic problems. Omicron was first detected in southern Africa. The World Health Organization says so far nearly 40 countries have logged cases of the new variant. Well, the number of COVID cases has increased in several countries amid the spread of that Omicron variant. Russia has announced nearly 33,000 daily infections and over 1,200 new deaths. It has imposed restrictions on travelers coming from South Africa, where the Omicron variant was first detected. Germany has announced a spike in its cases with over 64,000 daily infections. Australia says the number of people who tested positive for Omicron has grown to 13. India has also reported its third case of the new variant. Omicron was first detected on November the 24th. It has spread to nearly 40 countries. A preliminary study by South African scientists suggests that Omicron is highly transmissible and may evade some immunity to COVID-19. Well, in the Netherlands, thousands of people have taken to the streets to protest against government measures to contain a record coronavirus surge. The protest was held in the central city of Utrecht, with demonstrators carrying banners reading "Medical Freedom Now." Police forces were heavily present along the route of the march. Officials had set restrictions for the demonstration, including a maximum number of 5,700 participants. Protests, which have at times turned violent, began 3 weeks ago, shortly after the Dutch government made a lockdown announcement. Tighter restrictions have since come into force. Daily infections in the Netherlands reached a record high of nearly 24,000 late last month. The country has also become a hotspot for Omicron, with 18 passengers from South Africa testing positive. The Netherlands has had nearly 20,000 confirmed COVID-related deaths. Well, staying in Europe now, experts warn that energy poverty could impact up to 80 million people in the European Union before the end of this winter. This is while the bloc's leaders are struggling to agree upon a coordinated approach to address rising gas and electricity prices. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The European Commission's Joint Research Centre says 50 million people in the EU are suffering the effects of so-called energy poverty. It means households are having to prioritise food over heat. EU energy ministers have been meeting in Brussels to assess the crisis.
Since we launched our communication and toolbox on energy prices, 20 member states have taken or announced measures to mitigate the impact on their people and businesses, in particular the most vulnerable.
But that means almost a third of EU governments have not taken any action to protect citizens. Gas and electricity prices are out of control. Civil society organisations are forecasting that energy poverty will be hitting 80 million people in the EU before winter is over.
My invoice, energy invoice, has gone up from 70 to 110. That's a lot. The inflation has gone up. Families are struggling.
The second question is, of course, to know what the EU is doing at the EU level, you know, to handle the situation. And they have a responsibility, and there is a lack of political will for the moment by the politicians, I believe, to do something about it.
The EU's dysfunctional energy market is currently in a state of flux. The bloc is heavily dependent on Russia's gas. The European Commission confirms Moscow is fulfilling all of its supply contracts. However, energy storage is a problem in the EU. Supplies were depleted last winter due to unusually cold weather. Then there was huge demand when EU nations began lifting COVID-19 restrictions. Energy experts say the EU could benefit if it improved relations with Russia. The 27-country bloc could also push back against US foreign policy so that new supply chains could be utilised, for example, with respect to Iran, which has enormous energy reserves. EU leaders are divided over how to deal with the crisis, but it's clear there are no quick fixes. The matter will be high on their agenda when they meet here in just under 2 weeks' time for a summit on the 16th of December. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And now to Indonesia, where one person has died and dozens have suffered burns following a volcanic eruption on the island of Java. Mount Semeru has been sending a large plume of smoke and ash into the sky since Saturday afternoon. Well, the smoke plume has reportedly reached a height of over 12 kilometers, forcing thousands of nearby residents to flee. Airlines have been warned that the ash cloud could rise up to 15 kilometers. Officials say a number of areas went dark after being covered by volcanic ash. Well, the lava flow has also destroyed a road and a bridge. Evacuations are underway as we speak. Now, the Southeastern Asian country is home to nearly 130 active volcanoes. In late 2018, an eruption in the strait between Java and Sumatra Islands caused a tsunami which killed more than 400 people. And with that, it brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
In recent months, robberies have been more visible in the United States, with several involving large groups rushing into stores and coming out with armloads of goods. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Michael Corkery, Sapna Maheshwari, and Jim Tankersley. The piece is titled, "Thefts, Always an Issue for Retailers, Become More Brazen." Stay with us for more. Flash mobs swarmed through a Nordstrom in Northern California and two Best Buy stores in Minnesota, running out with arms full of merchandise. Five thieves steal $20,000 in products from an Ulta Beauty store in Pennsylvania in just 40 seconds. A security guard is fatally shot in Oakland, California, while working with a local television news crew, reporting about a recent retail robbery by a group of thieves. Theft is an ever-present issue for retailers in the United States. As much as $68.9 billion of products were stolen from retailers in 2019, according to one industry group. But it has become more visible, more brazen and violent in recent months, forcing an industry already buffeted by pandemic lockdowns and fights over mask requirements to deal with a new problem. This level of violence has taken it to a whole new level, says Rachel Michelin, president of the California Retailers Association. No one has seen this before. Luxury retailers in Union Square in San Francisco, the site of several high-profile robberies this year, have boarded up windows to prevent more mayhem. Best Buy warned last week that theft was lowering profit margins, and said it was using QR codes for checkout in some areas so employees did not need to unlock items right away. Home Depot has hardened its stores, putting power tools and other valuables out of reach, and advising employees not to film robberies with their mobile phones because it could escalate the situation. It has become second nature to take out your phone and record something when it is happening, said Scott Glenn, vice president of asset protection at Home Depot, but these people are getting violent. Retail executives and security experts link the thefts to a confluence of factors, but primarily the ease with which thieves have been able to resell stolen goods on internet in places in websites like Amazon and Facebook. But even industry veterans who have been tracking generations of shoplifters have been stunned by the methods and mindset of the thieves, saying they reflect a sense of impunity. Some recent robberies in which large groups rush into a store, overwhelm employees and flee in cars before the police can respond recall the looting that occurred across the country amid protests after the murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. At that time, people took advantage of police departments stretched by the protests and ransacked hundreds of stores, including the Macy's in Herald Square, and many smaller retailers, causing millions of dollars worth of damage. As tensions spread across the nation, major retailers like Nordstrom and Target would not discuss the extent of damage to their stores or how many they had to close during protests, instead focusing on their empathy for the demonstrators. The designer, Marc Jacobs, wrote on Instagram, "Never let them convince you that broken glass or property is violence. Property can be replaced, human lives cannot. With the unrest subsided, retailers are less reluctant to talk publicly about theft. Looting in general started during civil unrest, and it has now evolved, said Ben Duggan, president of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail, a trade group focused on crime at retailers. Criminal organizations saw during civil unrest that they were able to get their hands on millions of dollars of stolen products very quickly. The rise in thefts comes as punishments for retail theft have been broadly eased over the past decade. Since 2005, 30 states have increased the dollar threshold for theft offenses, which effectively means that fewer people are going to jail for smaller thefts, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. More than half of the states now have a felony theft threshold of $1,000 or more. The theft laws were changed to help reduce incarceration rates across the country, and some studies have found that the lower penalties have not led to more crime. And many of the most brazen crimes committed around Thanksgiving far exceeded the $1,000 threshold. Still, the thefts are being politicized, with some leaders saying they show the failure of decriminalization efforts. Others worry that the recent crimes could be used as a pretext to ratchet up penalties and incarceration rates again. Some industry experts say the problem is not necessarily the laws, but the lack of enforcement by the police and prosecutors, which emboldens enterprising thieves. A big priority, they say, should be breaking up the criminal organizations directing and profiting the most from the thefts. Ms. Michener, the head of the California Retail Trade Group, has been meeting with local prosecutors and the governor's office, which has established a task force on organized retail crime, trying to raise the urgency of prosecuting these cases. "The level of organized retail theft we are seeing today is simply unacceptable," California's Governor Gavin Newsom said in a statement. He added, "Businesses and customers should feel safe when doing their holiday shopping." Speaking to reporters on Friday, 3rd of December, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said federal law enforcement officials had been in contact with jurisdictions where we have seen this high level of retail theft. She added that the FBI was working with a task force led by the Los Angeles Police Department, and that the Justice Department was providing money to hire 50 additional police officers in San Francisco, California. Both the cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco have experienced high-profile retail robberies in recent weeks. Mr. Duggan, who has worked with a slew of major retailers and pharmacy chains like Walgreens, said that often the people snatching items are paid small fees like $500 for each robbery, which then feed larger enterprises that resell the goods online. Typically, these robberies don't involve large groups looting stores, but instead are smaller thefts that build up over time. In one recent case, a 70-year-old man in Atlanta, Georgia, paid recovering drug addicts to steal razors and health products from stores like Target, CVS, and Publix, and take them to his warehouse, according to court documents. The man, Robert Whitley, then sold the items online through businesses called Closeout Express and Essential Daily Discounts. He sold more than 140,000 items on Amazon's marketplace, totaling $3.5 million, according to federal prosecutors. Robert Whitley's lawyer said the thefts never involved violence. He said Mr. Whitley, who had struggled with drug addiction himself, ran support groups and provided shelter for others struggling with substance abuse. Robert Whitley, who pleaded guilty to one count of interstate transportation of stolen property, was sentenced in October to nearly 6 years in federal prison. His daughter, Nonnie Whitley,